work in all kinds of weather to keep your utilities running. Help keep them safe by slowing down near work zones and giving them space to do their job. For more winter safety tips, visit utilitieskingston.com. Stay safe and stay prepared.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Hello, it is now 5 o'clock here at CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and you are listening to The Corridor, bringing you local and regional news from Kingston and the surrounding area, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and for our podcasts, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. Thank you for joining us. And welcome to The Corridor, brought to you by Realtor Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Connect with Kim today to find a new home tomorrow via kimpurcell.ca. I'm Dinah Jansen. Our top story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie, covering Kingston City Council's approval of new funds for Queen's University's Tricolor Labs.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 5 p.m. Or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca. Council has unanimously approved $3 million in funding for the development of Tricolor Labs, a shared, industry-ready wet lab and biomanufacturing facility planned for Botterill Hall at Queen's University. Ben McGillwam with Kingston Economic Development Corporation spoke to the demand for the facility and the benefit of having it in Kingston.
So the primary users of the lab are going to be fully funded, commercializing stage life sciences companies looking for lab space, spinouts from the university and the college, and then other regional spinouts looking for BSL2 lab space, and scaling life science companies within the region, looking for short-term leases anywhere from 10 weeks to over a year. And then foreign direct investments looking for lab space to enter the North American market, kind of hitting the ground running. Tricolor Labs addresses a clear market demand across Ontario. There's a lack of wet lab space, especially the BSL2 for companies. And Kingston in particular has a severe lack of this space. The Tricolor Labs will integrate quite well with the Kingston ecosystem. The strengths that are Queen's University, the biotech program that's at St. Lawrence College, and the city's vision for a long-term health campus around a new hospital. This will be a feeder to that space. Kingston has a strong area of research and early stage innovation in the life sciences. We have programs like Dun & Desponsay's Queen's Innovation, a build-to-scale life science program where we see companies spinning out IP from the university into new businesses. Leveraging the research strengths that's at Queen's University and a lot of the equipment that is there that life science companies want.
Jesse Coobs with Economic Development at Queen's University also spoke before council to how Queen's is uniquely positioned to meet this demand for lab space.
Queen's University is uniquely positioned to host Tricolor Labs. It has established programs and offers entrepreneurial and IP support necessary for early stage companies. The campus has established BSL 1 and 2 wet lab infrastructure, specialized equipment, and full biosafety and waste management framework already in place. It also has state-of-the-art animal facilities that help bridge the preclinical gap that often exists for startups. And importantly, Queen leads numerous clinical trials locally and internationally, meaning companies have the ability to plug directly into clinical research pathways as well. The eighth floor of Botterill Hall provides an ideal foundation for Tricolor Labs footprint. It already contains existing BSL 1 and 2 wet lab space, autoclaves, fume hoods, waste systems, all connected by secure card access hallways. The vision is to update and modernize the existing space into flexible modular suites similar to smart labs style facilities that are in global innovation centers, enabling multiple firms to collate safely with direct access to Queen's core facilities. Second floor is another area that's been designated with an open concept layout, growth-friendly space, ideal for companies looking for collaborative and scalable workspace. Shared equipment that is essential that would be cost prohibitive for companies, but it allow companies to grow and collaborate.
McIlwain and Koobs were given another opportunity to highlight the university's unique positioning for this project when asked by council how much this project would cost without the existing infrastructure at Queen's.
So I think the ballpark of that would be around $1,500 a square foot. Just to renovate it was over $1,000 a square foot, plus the planning and permitting, and then finding the space that would fit the needs.
I'll just add quickly, to set up a biosafety level 2 building without the infrastructure would be millions and millions of dollars. The opportunity here is that we'll leverage existing infrastructure that is multi-million dollars of equipment and already established programs that we can leverage.
The funding is conditional on securing and maintaining additional government funding, finalizing governance and oversight structures, and executing formal funding and collaboration agreements between the City of Kingston, Kingston Economic Development Corporation, and Queen's University. The city's contribution will be limited to capital and equipment costs only, with no responsibility for operating, maintenance, or lifecycle expenses. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Coming up next, we have a story read by CFRC's Henry Walker, written by Michelle Dory Forestell, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Kingstonist, on local support for guests from the Keshetchewan community.
Thank you, Dinah. More than a month after arriving in Kingston, residents from Keshetchewan First Nation are still living in hotel rooms far from home, adjusting to unfamiliar routines, coping with uncertainty, and navigating the emotional strain of displacement. More than 250 people from the Northern Ontario Cree community were relocated to Kingston beginning Sunday, January 11, 2026, after a critical failure in Keshetchewan's water system left residents without safe drinking water. Many are considered Tier 1 or especially vulnerable evacuees, including elders, young families, and individuals with complex medical needs. At the center of local response is the Kingston Native Center and Language Nest, also known as KNCLN, which has been coordinating cultural supports, programming, and community connections for displaced people. For Executive Director Brandon Markle, the situation is both deeply personal and painfully familiar. When families first arrive, they cope, Markle said. But as the days turn into weeks, it takes a toll on your spirit, mind, and emotions. Our role at KNCLN is to soften the impact, to make sure people feel supported, connected, and cared for while they are here. In the days leading up to the relocation, KNCLN staff moved quickly to prepare for what they expected would not be a short-term emergency. The organization connected with local hotels to discuss accommodations, drawing on lessons learned from previous evacuations elsewhere in Ontario, where cultural needs and trauma-informed supports were not always fully integrated. These conversations help staff anticipate the realities of longer stays, including the importance of cultural appropriate food, access to community gathering spaces, and emotional supports for families facing prolonged uncertainty. Markle explained, "We knew from past evacuations that you can't treat this like a temporary overnight situation," he said. "People need stability, dignity, and a sense of belonging." When the first families arrived at the airport, KNCLN staff and volunteers were there to meet them, including Cree speakers who could offer greetings in their first language. Some staff came on their own time, bringing hot food to provide comfort after long travel days. "The first moment matters," Markle said. "It sets the tone that you are not alone, that you are entering a community that sees you as a family." Despite those efforts, daily life remains challenging for many evacuees. Most are living in hotel rooms with small kitchenettes, sharing tight quarters as they adjust to unfamiliar foods, routines, and surroundings. For children, particularly those with complex health or developmental needs, the disruption can be especially difficult. Imagine moving a family with children who have autism or other needs into a small hotel room in the city they've never been to, Markle said. Even with support, it's incredibly overwhelming. To To help address those pressures, KNCLN began offering hot meals at the center, including foods that reflect traditional diets. Programming has also expanded into evenings and weekends, creating opportunities for Ketchikan residents to gather, socialize, and reconnect with cultural practices. The organization also worked with the emergency management contractor, the Lumex Group, coordinating the relocation to ensure shuttle routes included the native center, making it easier for families to access resources and supports and services. Markle said the community response has been strong. To quote, "I was honestly overwhelmed by how many volunteers and organizations reached out to ask how they could help, and then followed through," he said. "There's been a real effort to make sure families feel welcome." He added that local partners have helped families navigate services, providing culturally appropriate meals, supported education needs, and focused on responding to community requests rather than imposing solutions. At KNCLN, staff intentionally refer to displaced residents as kin rather than evacuees, language that reflects Indigenous approaches to community and belonging. "Indigenous kinship isn't as nuclear as Western models," Markle said. "These are neighbors joining our community, not just evacuees passing through." Rather than offering one-size-fits-all services, staff focus on responding to families' requests and building trust over time, what Markle describes as moving at the speed of a relationship. "We don't assume we know what people need," he said. "We listen, we build relationships, and we respond. One of the greatest challenges remains the uncertainty surrounding how long families will be displaced." Markle said that the Mushtagowuk Council Grand Chief and the Chief of the Ketchikan First Nation traveled to Kingston to meet with evacuees and provide updates on water testing and next steps, but timelines remain unclear. "The hardest part right now is the waiting," Markle said. "People don't know when they'll be able to get home, and that uncertainty creates a lot of stress." Displacement has also separated extended families relocated to different cities, including Niagara Falls, where roughly 900 people are staying. Markle said that separation carries particular weight within Indigenous communities, where extended kinship networks play a central role in daily life. He also emphasized that Cree culture and experiences differ significantly from those of other Indigenous nations, cautioning against treating Indigenous communities as a single group. He said the Cree have a distinct approach to communication, decision-making, and family relationships, differences that can shape how displacement is experienced and underscore the need for culturally informed supports. "When families are spread across multiple cities, that's another layer of trauma," he said. Ketchikan's water emergency is the latest in a series of recurring infrastructure challenges facing the remote community along the Albany River near James Bay. Like many First Nations reserves, the community was established on land chosen for colonial convenience rather than environmental sustainability, Markle said. Residents have faced repeated flooding, water treatment failures, and ongoing relocation discussions for decades. "You're talking about thousands of people leaving with repeated disruptions, flooding, water issues, and now the prospect of relocating their entire community," Markle pointed out. "That level of instability would be unimaginable for most municipalities." He added that in southern communities, such as Kingston or Napanee, similar infrastructure failures would likely be addressed quickly rather than persisting for years. KNCLN says it will continue providing meals, programming, cultural supports, transportation access, and advocacy for as long as families remain in Kingston. "Kingston has really stepped up," Markle said. "What matters most now is sustaining that care and understanding while families navigate something that is deeply difficult and uncertain."
Thank you, Henry, and thank you to Michelle Dory Forstel for that story. Coming up, CFRC student intern Juliana Gonsalves will read a story from Keith Dempsey, LGI reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, about the town of Gananoque's efforts to recruit new physicians.
Thank you, Dinah. Gananoque Council has approved a plan to fund physician recruitment incentives directly through the municipal tax levy as a part of the 2026 operating budget, aiming to strengthen efforts to attract family doctors to the community. In doing so, the town has joined other communities in the area who have adopted special tax measures in recent years to fund different aspects of healthcare, including Brockville and the United Counties of Leeds and Grenville. Council supported a resolution to create a dedicated budget line for the town's Physician Experiential Locum Grant Policy and Physician Recruitment Grant Program two initiatives designed to encourage physicians to practice. Under the motion, the town will allocate up to $42,500 annually from the general tax levy to support the programs, beginning with the 2026 budget. The decision comes as funding for municipal grants tied to casino slot revenue has declined, reducing the amount available for community initiatives and physician recruitment incentives that previously relied on the funding source. Genk first introduced experiential locum grant policy in August 2023 to help bring physicians to the community on a trial basis, allowing them to experience practicing locally before committing long-term. A broader physician recruitment grant program was later established in July 2024, further to support attracting doctors to serve local residents. In addition to securing ongoing funding for physician recruitment, council also approved reinstating the town's community grants program, allocating $42,500 for that initiative in the 2026 operating budget. The measures are intended to ensure stable, predictable funding for both physician attraction efforts and community grants, despite fluctuating casino revenues.
Thank you, Juliana, and thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Coming up next, we have a story by Ted Evans, LGI reporter for CJAI-FM, Amherst Island Radio, about the outcomes of Loyalist Township's determinations about the conduct of a town councillor.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca.
Loyalist Township Council heard a presentation about two formal complaints alleging that Councillor Jake Ennis contravened the township's code of conduct while supporting the appeal of a recent ward boundary bylaw. The final integrity report found that Ennis did not contravene the code. In May 2025, Council enacted a bylaw to establish a new ward boundary configuration. The bylaw was then appealed to the Ontario Land Tribunal by a township resident, and in December 2025, the tribunal repealed the bylaw. Integrity Commissioner with Ayrton Burliss LLP, John Mascarin, explained the complaints.
There were two complaints that were filed on September the 17th and 18th. They were formal complaints filed under the Code of Conduct. Both complaints raised virtually identical allegations against the councillor. They asserted that he contravened two sections, sections 2.2 and section 4.1H of the code, by publicly opposing the bylaw and actively supporting the appeal to the Ontario Land Tribunal. Specifically, the complaints alleged that the councillor promoted fundraising efforts, including a GoFundMe campaign to finance the appeal of the bylaw before the tribunal. There were allegations that the councillor attempted to find a straw person to file the appeal, and that his wife led the fundraising efforts. The complainants asserted that the councillor member's conduct in doing all of these things demonstrated a lack of respect for council's decision-making process and amounted to a covert attempt to undermine a council decision that he did not support.
Ms. Guerin talked about their decision-making process.
We refer to the standard of proof. It's on a civil standard, which is a balance of probabilities. So it's not like a criminal standard where it's beyond a reasonable doubt. All we have to do is find that we believe that the member may be more likely than not have contravened the code, and we could find a contravention. In this case, we did not find that. We found that it was the opposite. In our review of the materials and the evidence appeared to point to the member being entitled to do what he did without contravening the code.
Ms. Guerin talked about another case that influenced their decision.
One of the main reasons that we've made our determination is based on an Ontario Divisional Court decision in Jubinville versus Chatham-Kent. And that involved a decision of the of the municipality of Chatham-Kent, and Councillor Jubinville fighting against the decision and continuing to disagree with the decision afterwards. And that was brought before the integrity commissioner in Chatham-Kent. And the integrity commissioner made a determination on a provision that is very, very similar to the one that is at play in this matter. And in that case, the integrity commissioner felt that Councillor Jubinville's efforts to fight against the decision of council to seek an overturning of council's decision was wrong and unreasonable. And that went to court. And the court said the integrity commissioner's determination was itself unreasonable and overturned the decision.
Mascarin explains why this case may be even stronger.
In this particular case, it's an even stronger indication because there is an as-of-right appeal to any person to be able to file an appeal. We believe that the determination in Jubinville aligns very, very closely to this particular instance. And in fact, this case may be even stronger because there is an as-of-right appeal to bring forward an appeal to the Ontario Land Tribunal from a ward boundary review bylaw.
Ms. Guerin detailed their final conclusion.
Our ultimate determination is that Councillor Innes did not breach the Code of Conduct Section 4.1H, and that is our determination. We did not feel that he disrespected Council's decision. He had a different view, and he attempted to use his rights at law to counter that, whether it was working with someone helping forward with the matter. Our conclusion is, on a balance of probabilities, we are not satisfied that Councillor Innes failed to respect council's decision-making process in accordance with the specific wording of the code of conduct. His conduct consisted solely of publicly expressing disagreement and supporting a lawful appeal process, and perhaps efforts to propagate a different view from council.
Innes speaks about the importance of the decision.
I think the commissioner's decision is an important one. It offers needed clarity on the code for members and for members of the public. I think the opportunity probably exists or may exist for loyalist staff and council at some point in the future to consider updating loyalist code of conduct to ensure that its language is clear and current in light of this decision and in comparison to the codes of other municipalities. I think it's worth noting that it's not just this complainant that had this notion that, you know, once council makes a decision, councillors are compelled to agree with it or remain silent. I can remember doing AMO, you know, introduction to being a councillor type training in my first year, and the instructor there referred to the same old notion. You know, even then, I didn't obviously agree with it, with the notion. For me, it was clear and is clear that I did not run for council to remain silent when I disagree with the majority of council. I ran for council to, in my view, represent the public interest. I think this decision and the related OLT or bylaw decision are two important positives for the advancement of democratic principles in Loyalist Township.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Coming up next, we have Brenda Little, LGI reporter for CJPE County FM in Picton, covering the future of family farming in Prince Edward County.
Agriculture has always been an important part of Prince Edward County, where generations of families have been producing food for the region and beyond. But things are changing. Rising costs, climate change, labor shortages, and lack of succession are squeezing farmers and eroding profitability. Prince Edward County's Economic and Development Team examined four sectors, including farm market, apples and grapes, on-farm diversification, and future of the family farm. Economic Development Officer Karen Palmer tells us more.
Karen, you've been running some surveys and some workshops over the last couple of months. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
So we do something every year called a business retention and expansion survey. So we usually do it by sectors, and this year happens to be on the agricultural sector. So we start with a digital or online survey that kind of gives us an overview of biggest challenges and sort of the makeup of the sector. And then we've been adding in some focus groups to try and drill down on some of the issues that have been raised.
What will you do with the information?
Well, we're just getting started. So we've done the survey, the four focus groups, and now I need to do some one-on-one outreach, really get some deeper understanding of certain sectors or certain subsectors, I guess I should say. Usually what I tend to do is we do a data analysis of the stuff that has come in through the online survey, and then I tend to write a report for council outlining these are some of the issues that we need to be aware of that are happening in the sector, both barriers or challenges and opportunities, and look at the ways in which the municipality might think about supporting different things. So, you know, at today's session we heard about the farmers market. So is there a way that the municipality could expand or make space available for a four-season market? Some things that are a little stickier, you know, around land use and other things, but I think what the next step over this process is really talking internally even about here's what we've heard. Now what do we do?
And then, of course, there's restrictions with the province. I mean, it's one thing for the municipality to say, okay, we can change this, this, or this, but they've also got restrictions with the province, right?
That's right. It's more complicated than you would think it would be. And sometimes it's, I mean, I think one of the things that really came through at today's session is that even with, you know, you're hearing at one table, it'd be nice if severances were easier so that when our farm is struggling, we could get a little bit of money from a land sale. And then you hear at the next table, we wish there were not as many severances because it's harder for our farm to expand if there are all these houses around it. So within this sector, there's a lot of differing opinions. And I think that's something that we need to kind of do a little bit more exploration around.
And you had broken this down into four sectors. So there was the farmers market, apple and grape growers, mm-hmm. diversification, and then, of course, the farmers today. And they all come with a different slant, I would think.
They do. I mean, you think about the scale at the farmers market level versus the scale at what we would have heard today. Yeah, there's much different challenges no matter which little part you're in. And I think for, you know, we sort of pulled out the wine growers for the simple reason that right now almost half of them are looking at, they either are for sale or they're looking at going for sale. And to me, that spells that we've got a little bit of an issue there that we need to be looking at in terms of succession. And since the wine sector is so important to the tourism sector, it can have a knock-on effect if we start to lose that.
Do you think changes can be made as a result of all of this?
I mean, I think there's lots of different things we can be thinking about. I think it helps us to know what people are talking about. I think for me, this feels like a sector. I grew up on a farm, but I feel like I know very little about it here. So it's excellent to kind of get this sense of differing perspectives. I think there's lots of things that internally we can think about in terms of some of it's cultural. When someone comes to you and says, I want to do this, how do we have that conversation without making it formal off the bat? How do we make it so that there is a little bit more back and forth between someone who wants to do something on their land versus someone who's working in government? So I think that's all part of the internal conversations of. And I would also say, you know, Prince Edward County has undergone such a tremendous change. I'm part of it too. I only moved here 8 years ago. So when you think about folks who are moving into this place and they love it because it's bucolic and beautiful, but they may not understand that also at certain times of year, there is a lot of heavy machinery on the roads, that there are calves that are crying for their mamas because they're being weaned. I think there's lots of things we can do to help people just understand farming better and help farmers coordinate, you know, tours or getting people onto farming scenarios that might help them learn a little bit more about mm-hmm. what farming actually is. Yeah.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us.
Hello, and welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC. So big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It's a great way to stay informed about all of the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on. Today, I'd like to introduce you to Hannah Burrows, who's doing a PhD in psychology under the supervision of Dr. Valerie Kuhlmeier. Welcome to Grad Chat, Hannah.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, and I'm really excited to dive into your research because it sounds super cool. But before we get into it, can you tell us a little bit about what attracted you to Queen's in the first place?
That's a great question. I've been here forever. People say I'm like the ancient Queen's person in our department, but I did my undergraduate research here, my master's work, and now my PhD.
Okay, very nice.
So I definitely started off being attracted to Queen's. I grew up in Ottawa, but from the research perspective, there were so many opportunities in the psychology department that made me really excited. My first thesis was in autism and ADHD, and I worked in the autism spectrum disorders lab, and I just fell in love with the research process. It was so stimulating, and I got to actually work with dogs in my third year with the First Many Dogs Project, which is a global consortium of researchers across the world doing the same research, trying to figure out the differences in culture across different dogs. Human populations. And from there, I was like, I need to study dogs. This is amazing. I can't believe I get paid to do this. It's awesome.
So your research currently is understanding dog-human relationships by linking guardian beliefs with real-time dog-guardian behavior to improve animal welfare and everyday interactions. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that looks like, what that means?
Yeah, so I guess I could backtrack a little bit to just describe my master's work.
Yeah.
So it kind of laid the foundation for what I want to do in my PhD. So first thing I did, I developed a survey, which is called PUPS.
That's great.
Yeah, thank you so much. A lot of iterating just on that part of the research, but it stands for the Perception of Undesirable Pet Behavior Survey. So a lot of the work that's been done in dogs prior is not super naturalistic, and it doesn't really generalize when we're looking at how people perceive their dogs and if that's a self-fulfilling prophecy or not to the types of behavior that show up in the different areas that you are. So our idea was looking at how can we first contextualize it? Mm-hmm. So if I have an issue with my dog and I tell someone I have a bad dog or my dog is poorly behaved, it doesn't really tangibly provide a great example for a person that can help you in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea with this research was sort of looking at, okay, we can survey people. And through the survey, what did we get, right? Like, what are those areas where we can work on our dog's behavior, but also be more cognizant as the person that probably is impacting it a little bit more than even the dog, right? It's a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. So we ended up finding four different areas. So it was like public behaviors, training behaviors, fear and distress or anxiety, and then home-related behaviors. And from this, I actually had a two-part study basically for my master's. With the PUPS research, we were able to take the PUPS into real life. So when you're approaching a difficult situation, say there's food on the ground and you don't want your dog to eat it, what actually happens? So that was the second portion. We had people come into the lab and we did actual like real-time behavioral data, and that was what basically like started all of our interest around this.
And then with your PhD work, where are you headed now with this project?
Yeah, so based on this, some of the findings we found that are pretty interesting that I want to dive into a little bit more are there's different beliefs that obviously predicted different guardian behaviors. So the guardians who are actually more worried or fearful about their dog's behavior, regardless of however the dog acted, were actually more likely to disengage when they actually needed to, like, provide context or scaffolding for the dog to understand why the behavior was bad or not. So that's super interesting. It could be its whole, like, side study if we wanted to do that. And another one was looking at dogs of more concerned guardians actually spent more time monitoring the food. So they actually spent, like, less time sort of, like, looking at their guardian or, like, watching them attentively. So there's some training implications there, which I'm really interested in. And it's a bit of a segue into what I want to do for my PhD, which is working with working dog populations. So there's so many different types of, like, working dog relationships. Like, there's endangered species detection. So some people go and train dogs to collect scat, and then we can use that scat so we don't have to actually capture endangered species and understand the dynamics ecologically of those populations. I'm really interested in working with more applications that have to do with, like, seeing guide dogs, police work. We just did a really big survey in our lab, which is over 500 police dog trainers and handlers across the world.
Wow.
And looking at what they need us researchers to provide them. And really interesting research questions that came out of that paper as well. So excited to dive into those things.
Okay, so you've got, yes, you've got lots of avenues on the go for your PhD, it sounds like, and all about understanding that human-dog relationship or dog-guardian relationship. Is that looking, like you mentioned working dogs, but your master's work was with pets as well, right? So you're looking at both pets and dogs who are working, but might be pets in their downtime, I guess, is how to say that.
Yeah, and, like, I think people think, especially in a North American context, like, our relationship with dogs is obviously very different in a Western cultural context. Also, like, primarily we call it, like, weird in psychology, where it's, like, Western, like, educated, industrialized. So there's, I think it's around, like, 20% or something of the global dogs in the world are companion animals, and they're also wild. So there's also, like, really interesting implications for, like, wild dog research that I really want to look into as well. Like, there's different contexts. Like, for example, in Bali, there's, like, kind of this, like, middle ground between, like, a companion versus a working dog, where, like, the dogs kind of just coexist with people. And they had a really bad feral dog population sort of problem where a lot of the dogs were really sick. But within their culture there, a lot of the offerings people would provide every morning ended up being more things the dogs could eat rather than just food that they had left out that maybe made dogs sick, and people were a little bit more responsive to that. And now I think they're almost at, like, 90% of dogs there that are, like, completely healthy.
Which
is, like, totally just a mindset of, like, a cultural change in a different environment. So, yeah, there's really interesting, like, the differences between companion animals and working dogs. But I'm really, my thing is looking at, like, how we can best teach people to understand dogs and how can that work in a working context, but also completely transferable to a companion animal.
Oh, that's really cool. Because I mean, like you said, in kind of a Western, a weird setting, as they call it, dogs are everywhere. So
yeah,
there's a lot of applications or potential applications for your work. What originally drew you to studying dog and human relationships?
Yeah, so I briefly mentioned this, but I'll totally shout out Many Dogs because I think it's a really cool thing. So I'm not sure how much you're aware of the replication crisis that happened in psychology, but it's been, like, a couple decades now of people trying to replicate, not really seeing this, like, I would say, like, seminal research papers that have been published, and people kind of saying, oh, I don't know how much this is transferable across different cultures or contexts, for example. So there's been this global movement of, like, the Many, Many Project.
Okay.
So there's, like, many babies, many otters, many dogs. And the first Many Dogs study was near the end of my undergrad. So very, very new research. But I got to actually take part in that, which was really cool. So our lab collected data, and I'm pretty sure there was something like 30 labs across the world. And we all did the same study. And then we all looked at, like, what are the differences there? Because ultimately, ultimately, like, there's a lot of places doing the same research, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. But then we're publishing findings that, like, can be contradictory or just may not really replicate across different samples, but we're saying they're generalizable. Mm. So it's, like, really helping people hold ourselves accountable as researchers, mm-hmm. which I find really awesome. And getting to do that work, I really, it's basically that project is looking at how do dogs respond to cueing and how we point. Because they have a really specific, really interesting way of, like, communicating with people, much better than a lot of different species. Mm. So that project, I was like, oh my God, this is awesome. Basically, my job was just holding a dog and, like, telling them to move around. And I was like, this cannot be research. Like, I feel very lucky. So as a dog person myself, I got really excited in it and wanted to keep doing it.
And then that led to your master's work. And now you're continuing to expand that in your PhD work.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yeah, completely.
And you mentioned this already about kind of how it's going to build a little bit on some of the work you've already done. Could you tell us a bit more, like, specifically about how your PhD research is going to build on your master's research? Like, you did two studies in your master's. Are you planning a few studies in your PhD? Like, what will it look like?
Yeah, so I wanted to shout out Dr. Tom Hollenstein, who's in the psych department. His work is specifically looking at developmental research, so between, like, usually dyadic stuff, which is totally, like, person-dog or dog for me, but he does, like, maternal-child sort of conflicts and things like that. So he has developed and really honed this methodology called the state space grid.
Okay.
So it's a way to visualize, like, the places that people get stuck in conversationally in terms of, like, do you really stick in this area? Where's the pain point between these two people? And there's a lot of really cool quantifiable ways to look at it. So this method also provides a visual view of it, which is pretty cool because then you can see, like, also what you're describing. It's never been used with animals before.
Okay.
So what we're trying to do at the moment is taking my master's work and trying to decipher how to put that into a state space grid so we can visually see, like, where do dogs and people get hung up on when they're in this sort of challenging situation? Mm. And can we pinpoint those parts? And with dogs especially, like, obviously there's a power dynamic compared to two humans having a conversation. But it'll be interesting to see, like, how much, kind of that helicopter parenting approach. Like, if I have this view of my dog before I go into a situation, and am I proactively impeding my dog from interacting and learning in a way that I also think might be helping them? And can we, like, actually visually see, like, okay, at 30 seconds in this interaction, that's when you didn't really provide your dog the context to move forward or understand or learn from the situation? So that's the first step with that. And then trying to take that tool into hopefully, like, a veterinarian context or a working dog context, or when we select dogs for different training, for example, like PTSD with veterans. There's so many places that, like, we use dogs as tools, really, but we don't really look at, like, how to best train or really select from the person side and the dog side.
Oh, okay, So from the state space type of method, when you were describing your master's work with dogs approaching food and then seeing how that would go, would that look something like, I mean, this is all ideal once you've mapped it on the method, but it would be like, okay, we see, say, an anxious guardian who's already worried about their dog eating something they found in this context, in a research context, but, you know, they found on a walk or something, and they start to, you know, at 15 seconds, they start to tense up. And at 20 seconds, the dog realizes and then also starts to look more at the food instead of the person. Or is that the kind of thing that you would be able to map 100%. Using the state space method? Okay.
Yeah. I think the other cool thing is, like, that's totally at the individual level. Super interesting and informative. But when we're looking at, like, we had 111 dogs and people come in for just my master's, the in-person portion.
Wow, that is a lot of data to work with.
A lot of data. And the pups, we had, like, over 600.
Wow.
Yeah, so with looking at that, that's really interesting as a generalizable population just in Kingston. What are the tendencies and can we group those, right? Say, like, around this one particular point in time, when we kind of code, we don't really see those things. We can kind of decipher, like, a relationship, but visually seeing, oh, 40% of our sample that is real, that 40% that when we look at pups, like, they're super anxious. in the first 20 seconds, they actually don't even let their dog, like, sniff anything, for example. That's just a super, like, extreme example.
Or, like, what you could see or what themes you could pull out from that visual.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. Yeah, which is cool.
Well, and that would, I mean, I guess it'll have to, you'll have to wait and see what the method reveals to you, but that could tell you a lot of different things to move forward with.
It's kind of tangential, but even with this type of research, there's so many different, like, ways to analyze it. Mm-hmm. Like, what we kind of did was looking at basically just behavior. We're looking at coding it on a continuous scale. Mm. But I'm really interested in looking at people's voice changes and how much, like, they even gender their dog. There was so many different versions of people that actually were way... Their people that had their dogs that were more attentive to them used gendered language towards their dogs.
Oh, interesting.
And just, like, super random finding that, like, could be its own study, like, which is cool, too.
Well, it sounds like you have a lot of really rich, robust data just from your previous work, and then you're about to build on this as well and build this really new kind of novel data set. Well, sets of data, I guess, not even just one, but all these sets of data to be able to work with into the future as well, hopefully, and other folks as well.
Yeah, we're really excited about that. I think, too, like, a lot of this work prior has been really informative, but not necessarily super naturalistic, which has been a critique of, like, just impulsivity research with dogs, but also how do you sort of decipher, like, what impulsivity is, right? Like, it could be, like, is my dog super reactive and jumpy? Or, like, is my dog, is it only around squirrels, like, food? How much can you contextualize it to help somebody understand their dog better? And the kind of the implications of this, too, are, like, a lot of dogs were adopted during the pandemic, but a lot were relinquished right when people were starting to go back to work. Because behaviorally, they were, like, a huge change happened between everybody's lives. And they kind of got this companion animal thinking that this would be a good relationship. And then when behavioral things started coming up, when people got more social, a lot of people, there's, like, millions of dogs that got relinquished across North America.
Yeah.
So there's also, like, implications just for people to better be more responsible dog owners, but also, like, be more cognizant about that relationship with the animal when we decide to take it into our care as well.
Well, and of course, I mean, if you describe it, like, if you were to put a human in the context of a dog who was adopted during COVID, if you're like, oh, you met a new friend, they came to live with you as a roommate, and you spent 24/7 together during lockdown, and then suddenly you had to go back to work, but the roommate was no longer able to interact with you or anyone else while you were gone all day at work.
Yeah.
Of course, there'll be behavioral changes. And then if you, you know, apply that back to a dog, of course, it makes sense that there's lots. I mean, that's earth-shattering for the dog.
Even, right? So. Like, breed-wise, right? Like, some people think, like, oh, I got this dog because it's really cute. But, like, that breed was made to be, like, chasing sheep 24/7 out on, like, 17 acres of land in Scotland, right? Like, it's a really specific way of, like, viewing a dog. But all those things, context-wise, are so important to understanding our dog's behavior.
Yes, much more than cuteness.
Exactly.
So how do you think this research could eventually support everyday dog owners with companion animals or professionals with working dogs?
Yeah, I think a main thing I really wanted to look at for my master's was, like, removing the potential label of a problematic dog, especially when their guardian or owner is a person that you could tell just when people would come in, sometimes they'd be like, oh, my dog is, like, so poorly trained. And then you sort of watch them interacting and it's like, you don't really give your dog a chance sometimes too. And also it's usually, like, it's a two-way street. Like, they say, like, there's a really interesting paper that is, like, stress runs from both sides of the leash. Like, dogs tend to be, like, quite big mirrors, even, like, physiologically, like, with cortisol, stress, anxiety, depression. Like, I think to better inform people to understand that, like, dogs are really intertwined in our lives, probably more than we even notice, because it's one of those things, like, when you haven't seen somebody for a long time, you're like, you look different. Like, when you're living with them all the time, it's a completely different relationship. But the idea, especially with pups, was looking at, like, a more context-based measure of, can we pinpoint those pain areas? Is there a way to better perform like a very quick and dirty version of what's your issues, mm-hmm. and then can we train that way? Can we help you feel more confident, right? Because mm-hmm. ultimately we're just looking at beliefs mm-hmm. and how beliefs affect behavior. And it shouldn't be that big of a deal, but obviously given our current political climate and how the world is, I think it's a very interesting time to look at how much do we believe and how does that impact how we act, right? Mm-hmm. And like, I can say one thing, but the next day I can do a completely different thing, mm-hmm, right? Those mm-hmm. things don't really always, they're not always set in stone. So I think researching how we believe and what we think about our animals is really important to inform how to actually train them. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the idea of like bridging science with also like everyday pet ownership.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's really interesting. And it's, I don't know, this is totally anecdotal from mm-hmm. my personal experience, but I like dogs. I don't have my own dog, but I'm not good at setting boundaries with dogs. And I find that my friends' dogs know that immediately, and they will push. They'll put, you know, if they're, for example, if a dog isn't supposed to jump on someone and they know that, well, they come to me, they jump on me right away because they know I'm not going to stop them, right? Like, I'm like, oh, you're so cute. You know, mm-hmm. so they push the boundary because they get a sense right away that my belief about them is that it's okay. And I'm not going to, like, maybe, I don't know, punish or, you know, stop that behavior is the same thing. So dogs usually push limits with me that they wouldn't with their owners because totally. I think they can sense right away that I'm the weakest link.
Or the best one, right? Yeah. And it's like, that's the thing. It's totally based up to perception. Mm-hmm. Like somebody, there's a really interesting paper that kind of, I would say like it inspired this work and then we took it a totally different direction. But it was the first paper to look at pet parenting styles developed from human developmental parenting styles mm-hmm. and looking at those differences in that relationship. I think they've only used it in one population. So again, replication crisis, mm-hmm. take everything with a grain of salt. But they've basically found like there are patterns across, there are patterns across like if I'm authoritarian, how much my dog actually problem solves or like persists in a certain situation. Like things that I think when we talk about them may be more intuitive. But if I were to say like across the three different parenting styles, which do you think your dog would persist more? I don't think people would really know, right? Mm-hmm. So there's even how we tend to like own and like have this sort of power over the animal. Like it's definitely not, there's a power imbalance in mm-hmm. that relationship. It's pretty interesting to think about like even how we say that we're acting and what we believe to be the case with parenting styles. It's kind of the same thing. Like I think some people may say they're more authoritative but end up being more authoritarian or permissive, for example. Mm-hmm. And it's totally up to that person's belief.
Oh, right. That's fair. Yeah. Well, I guess in the case of my friend's dogs, I am certainly a permissive permissive guardian in when I visit with friend's dogs because, yes, they get away with it.
Yeah. That's awesome.
And so you're doing all of this really incredible work. And I know on top of that, you also keep really busy outside of the lab. Can you tell us a little bit about the textbook that you developed and what that was all about?
Yeah, definitely. So huge shout out to Dr. Megan Norris. She is the best. She's the undergraduate chair of psychology. She runs a course in fourth year for students. So you get the opportunity to TA Psych 100, which is mm-hmm. awesome. But at the same time, she really challenges you in her whole sort of, there's an exam, but the main project through the course of the course is solving an issue with education.
Okay.
Super broad, right? Mm-hmm. It can be super daunting. But she really guides you in a way that, like, you think a lot, quite deeply about, like, what are some issues in education. And it could be higher education, it could be elementary. But with our group, we were like, okay, let's just go talk to people first. Mm. And we talked to a bunch of students. And we surveyed 500 students
wow.
on Queen's campus. And again, this is quite a privileged institution. Like, and still, like, the main pain point of every single student was money, paying for school across Canada. So when we realized that, we were looking into, like, okay, what are the ways that people can get money and funding? Mm-hmm. And we found that millions of dollars of scholarship money goes unclaimed every single year due to a lack of applicants. Mm-hmm. And there's just money that's left on the table.
Yeah.
So our solution there was creating a free open access textbook that we wrote, and each chapter basically walks you through like how to get a scholarship, how to do it safely, what are the aspects of applying to higher education that are beneficial to you and how can you interact with that in a way that you can feel empowered. Mm. And each chapter has been expertly reviewed by somebody in that field. So it's like completely peer reviewed and it's actually been published on the Queen's. So we have an ISBN. So it's a formally published resource. And through that, we won the National Financial Literacy of Canada's month. They have a competition for students every year, but it was actually published on Canada.ca too. That went into it. So a lot of it, we've had tens of thousands of people interact with the textbook, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. And we get people saying, like, I never thought I could go to school and I got a scholarship and it's changed my outlook on life.
Wow.
It's very awesome. So I feel very, very privileged to be a part of that. But it's a very, very awesome thing that I always push because it's called How to Pay for Post-Secondary.
Okay,
And it's through the eCampus project as well. So it's also, like, there's interactives. It's a fun, we have fun videos in there. Yeah, so it's awesome.
So if someone were to Google how to pay for post-secondary, that resource would come up from eCampus Ontario, and that's where to go?
Exactly.
Okay, yeah. Oh, wow. Well, that is incredible. Yeah. And that, what an impact, both through your research, but just through your advocacy, your team came up with. And that's all before you even started grad school. That's incredible.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, it was the same time as my undergraduate thesis that I was writing. So a lot of writing, big writing here. Yes. But yeah, I feel like it's the gift that keeps giving, which is really awesome.
Yeah, no, I will definitely. I think I have seen this resource before, and I will definitely search it out now to share that with other folks when questions come in, because that is such a helpful thing. And like you said, like, you don't want to leave money on the table. But at the same time, if you are maybe a high school student or a mature student looking to come back to school, you don't know what you don't know. So until you're already here, how would you know about all these opportunities and scholarships and fellowships that could be relevant to you?
I think the other thing too, like, you totally hit the nail on the head there with, like, so many people that I would say, like, really merit and should feel that way do not have that self-confidence.
Mm.
So a lot of the work that we were doing in terms of, like, writing to actually empower students, because, like, some of these people, like, they invented the soup kitchen. You look at their resume and you're like, how have you never applied to anything? Like, you're a superstar. One of my co-authors has this really funny way of, like, describing, like, don't say you're a cashier, like, say that you managed, like, the funds of a multi-million dollar corporation, you know? Like, which is, like, it's, like, we're totally swinging the extreme of that. But it's a good way to perceive it, where, like, you have developed so many skills in your life, and why not you? You know, totally reframe that. So that's a big part of the textbook as well, that I think more people should feel. And it's weird, like, people don't really talk about finances. Mm. It's kind of a sticky topic. Mm-hmm. I think generationally we're doing a little bit better in terms of, like, with social media and things like that. But it still is this uphill battle that, like, especially for intersectionality, like, women, like, a lot of groups that have never really seen people that have been successful in that. So we're currently collecting, like, it's kind of like snapshots from people that have won scholarships but represent a minority group. So we have different, basically, chapters that are coming out that are more like, this person looks like you. They've been able to do this. Like, feel empowered by that. Because, again, like, I understand my own intersectionality, and, like, we want to uplift people that haven't seen people from their group or identity, which are totally out there. But we need to give them the microphone, you know?
Yeah, no, of course. And I think another, like, this theme keeps coming through your work about, like, belief, right? Of, like, what people, self-perception or their belief about themselves, that kind of where that belief is can either limit or open up opportunities for them. So it sounds like your textbook with your co-authors is about getting people to believe in themselves a little bit more while still showing them scholarship opportunities and things like that, but building that belief in so that they'll actually, you know, take that leap and apply and then hopefully find success.
Totally. Yeah. And, like, really reframing whatever we think about ourselves to, like, I think especially, like, these places want you to succeed. That's why they have it. So if you think that you don't merit it, like, it's really your biggest obstacle in this case. Worst case is that you don't get it. But, like, it's totally spaghetti at the wall in this world, you know? Like, it's kind of the same with research. Like, the amount of times that you'll think, like, oh, this is going to be something that's super significant, and then there's a totally different tangential thing. But you did the work to get there. And I think the first step is always the most difficult, but the main thing people say is like, oh, like, starting where I started, I feel better about myself even. Mm. Even if you don't get the first couple, like, there's so many other opportunities mm-hmm. to practice talking about yourself in a way that you're like, you're selling yourself and like having, you're convincing yourself too that you merit that opportunity, mm-hmm. which I think is really, really awesome.
No, oh, that's super cool. So we'll have to get people to check that out. Mm-hmm. Check out the resource and see what options could be available to you. Mm-hmm. Hannah, it has been great chatting with you. Thank you for doing the show and the best of luck with the rest of your research.
Amazing. Thank you so much for having me.
So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download this show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. And until next week, this is KM on the FM. Grad Chat. Grad Chat.
Greetings, loved ones. This is DJ Nasty Nexus coming to you live and direct from CFRC 101.9. I'm here to bring you the goods from my new show, Classless Radio, airing every Friday night at 11 p.m. I'll be giving you hits and hidden gems all the way from jazz to blues and hip-hop and R&B. Music from the soul that everybody needs. Hop on my wavelengths and get right with the kid to kick off your big weekend. Stay tuned. I try my best just to be a
man. What's going on with you, Mr. McGregor? Tanya Dunhaskigo, then on Zewa Dahusa Dutch, Ungahuan, and Hadiwa Nodas, and the Aboriginal voices, Oscar Dewa Nyawar Oscar, Ne Jota FM, C.